This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm Ben Johnson. There's always plenty of gadget and software news out there, but not many people look directly at the big question. Is technology making us better or worse? There's a new volume that can be added to required reading on the topic. Clive Thompson is the author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. Hi, Clive.
Good to be here.
So, first of all, tell me why you're such an optimist.
Well, you know, I actually started as a pessimist. If you talked to me 20 years ago when I first started writing about the internet, I was like, the average person should not be given the keys to cyberspace. You know, like they're not smart enough. They're going to talk about dumb crap and society's going to go down the toilet. But I'm a reporter. And so I'm always out there reporting and talking to people. And basically what happened is over those 20 years, I just came to the conclusion that people were more interesting and they were more creative and they did funny, sort of clever things I would not have expected. Like I expected bad political conversation. I did not expect Wikipedia. I did not expect, you know, sort of Twitter conversations that turn into these fascinating rolling commentaries. I did not expect, you know, people hijacking Amazon review threads to sort of do political satire, right? There were so many interesting things that happened when people started living in public.
Your book starts with the game of chess and how a computer beat a champion in 1997. So how do computers learn and play chess differently than humans? Tell me about that.
Yeah, this is a fun story. So Deep Blue comes along and it beats Kasparov. And the reason it beats him is because it's doing brute force. It is not using intuition. It's just saying, okay, I'm a computer. I'm going to calculate 7 moves out from this board. And then the next move, I'll calculate 7 moves out. And I will just pick the best single move. That's all you have to do to beat a human. Go 7, 8 moves out, find every move, pick the best one. Humans don't work that way. We work with intuition. We sort of go, I feel like this is the right thing. And because I'm a chess master with enormous experience, my intuition is correct. But you can beat that intuition with brute force, right?
Tidal waves of data.
Exactly. The big data. So what Kasparov did next, he was really smart. He said, okay, I'm not going to beat the brute force, so let's do something – let's switch this game up. Let's play chess with a human and a computer versus a human and a computer, right? So now the human, the grandmaster with that intuition, can use the computer to war game interesting if-then experiments and play at a higher level. And that's exactly what happened. They began playing chess more creatively with crazier moves that no one had ever seen in the history of chess.
If you can't beat him, join him.
Exactly. Yeah, precisely. Yeah. Take the things. This is the lesson that animates my book. Humans are amazing at a particular type of thinking. Computers are good at this very brute force connection making. You put the two together and you get some remarkable thought.
Let's talk about creativity because I feel like this connects with that. Mm-hmm. Your story at the beginning of one of your chapters about sort of you and your wife finding Tori Amos with the help of Google. This constant ability to access memory in terms of the computer, the internet's memory as opposed to our own memories is a fascinating thing. But you also talk a little bit about how it could in some ways threaten creativity.
That's right. We've always used things outside of our brains to help us remember the facts because, frankly, our brains are terrible at facts. They're good at meaning, bad at facts, right?
Right.
And so, you know, the book came along. We have libraries. You know, the newspaper comes along. We have clipping files. We have notebooks. And now we have the internet that we use to ping for these quick facts. So that's great insofar as it fits into a long intellectual tradition. But there is a danger, which is that if you don't have a lot of knowledge in your head, you can't really have creative breakthroughs. We don't have creative breakthroughs by connecting things that are outside of our heads. It's when it's all loaded in there and you're in the shower or you're going for a walk and your sort of brain's doing this deep stitching together and you're like, oh my goodness, aha, that's where the eureka moments come from. So I do sort of point out that you know, creativity requires stuff inside your brain. What I heard from the memory scientists I talked to was that the people who really study memory deeply aren't particularly worried about us losing everything because the truth is when we're really obsessed with something, when we have a deep passion for something, it sticks. We hoover it up. We linger over it and it gets in there. And that's why, you know, you've got you know, a baseball fan that doesn't know his kid's birthday but has 7,000 statistics. Because he's anything you're passionate about, it gets in there. So the trick is, if you want to be creative about something, it has to be something you're passionate about, because then it will be in your head and it will stick.
Do you think that we're going to get to the point where we build a computer who can be creative in the shower like we are?
I don't think so, no. I think creativity is something that is a uniquely human virtue. The thing that computers are good at doing is finding connections between things that we can't observe ourselves, that we – that can spark an aha moment in us, right? Because creativity is really a combination – sorry. Because creativity is really a combinatorial – oh, my God, that's even worse. Because creativity is really about combining things together. You know, it's taking something from one field and bringing it in contact with something that you wouldn't have expected. And that happens really well inside our brains. The thing that computers can aid in this regard is in helping us connect more things together that we see in front of us. So when I go on Twitter and I'm talking about something and one of my followers goes randomly, "Oh, that's interesting. Have you seen this?" And that completely blows my mind and gives me a new idea. That is me using a network, a computerized network, to reach out and connect more forces and more people than I could on my own. But it still requires humanity. The creativity is always in the human.
But at the same time, it's interesting that you give that example, because to a certain degree, that's sort of like – that's what Google is trying to do, right? It's trying to get to this point where you actually don't need your friend to say to you, "Oh, well, that's interesting. Have you seen this?" Because that's sort of what some search engines are trying to do.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, like, well, with Google, the whole Google Now thing is they want to try. We're going to predict, what you're going to think of next. You know, it's almost a sort of pre-crime stuff from Minority Report. Yeah. Personally, I think there's a limit to what they'll be able to do, because they can be pretty good at the low level stuff. They can be pretty good at, like, okay, you're driving here, you need to know the weather. You know, you've been reading these stories, maybe you should read this story, but the really big creative things come from such unpredictable combinations that it strikes me as vanishingly unlikely that there's any way you can do that. To a certain extent, Google is anti-serendipity. They're trying to find the next sort of immediate step. But serendipity is about this crazy connection that you could never have predicted. I don't think they're going to be able to do it. And to a certain extent, I'm not even sure it's their goal.
Tell me about this idea of pluralistic ignorance and how you think technology is changing that and helping us move away from it.
Sure. Pluralistic ignorance is a sociological concept that basically says a lot of social ills persist because we're not aware of what our fellow citizens think about something. So back in the 60s, there was a lot of situations in which segregated housing remained segregated because everyone thought their neighbor was more racist than they actually were, right? You know, like you would not have a play date with someone, you know, with the black kid down the street or the white kid down the street, because you thought that everyone was more racist than they were and you don't want to step out of line. And what the way you dispel pluralistic ignorance is when you start talking about what you actually think. Same thing happens on campus. Kids think that the average student has way more sex than they're actually having. Or even worse, they think everyone's drinking more than they're actually drinking. Mm-hmm. And so you get these individual situations of binge drinking where someone is trying to live up to a fictitious real. And so campuses have fought binge drinking by essentially showing kids what the real actual drinking rate is. It's not 7 drinks a night. It's 2 drinks a night. And they get them to talk to their friends about it and say, "How much are you actually drinking?" "Oh, yeah, I'm drinking 2 drinks a night, dude." And so you can dispel the pluralistic ignorance about how much everyone's drinking, and you can produce a better situation. Social ills in many situations, not always, but many situations persist because we're simply not aware of what everyone around us is thinking. So the great thing about the internet is that it is in many ways primarily a place where we go to talk about what's on our minds, what we're thinking, what we're seeing, what annoys us, what cheers us. And that can – it doesn't always, but it can have some fantastic effects in breaking down this ignorance that keeps many social ills in place.
I talk to a lot of people on a regular basis about the idea of the internet as a sort of wild, wild west, a place where – anything and everything does exist. I forget what the Reddit rule is, but if there's like a rule, you know, whatever thing you can guess, there's porn of that thing.
That's called Rule 34. If it exists, there is porn for it. Right. And in fact, actually, as an example of public thinking, I once tweeted with someone about this. And I said, so is there – if Rule 34 is true, there must be porn about Rule 34. And so I just tweeted this, and within minutes, several people had found porn written about Rule 34 and public thinking in action.
So my question is – a lot of people, you know, just talk about this massively open, broad nature of the internet. But you see some of the ways that some of the telecommunications industry is behaving, certain companies trying to build more closed systems. A lot of people that I talk to on a regular basis are concerned with what is happening in various industries to actually cut down on some of this traditionally free, internet space. And did you come into contact with this issue while researching the book? And is it, I don't know, what do you think about that? Is it a concern?
I think that is an absolutely real concern. It's true. What I encountered over and over again as I talked to people was that the most interesting forms of thinking were often happening in places away from things like Facebook or whatnot. Because Facebook is really trying to sort of constantly nudge your behavior in certain ways. You know, they want you to post lots of photos of a certain type because that keeps your friends engaged. They're constantly doing this sort of behavioral nudging as they try and figure out how to serve you more ads. And it makes it a much less dynamic and creative space compared to like the sort of crazy open web of 10 years ago. And whenever I ran into people that were doing genuinely intellectually amazing things, it was often on these free tools or simple tools, not these convoluted services that people are trying to suck us into. And I do think this is a danger. I think that if we allow too much of our public lives to happen on three or four large corporations that really exist to try and sell us ads, that can actually corrode and tamp down the dynamism of our public thinking.
So what have you seen then that gives you hope about facing that challenge?
You know, what I would say is that I have noticed a lot of people become very disenchanted with Facebook in particular because they can now feel that behavioral nudging, that ad-based nudging on a daily basis, and they don't like it anymore. Mm. And what they've also noticed is that they prefer simple tools that they understand. One of the reasons why Twitter is something that a lot of people told me I still like that one is because it's uncomplicated. You're posting something publicly. You know it's public. You can see who's linked to it. There's none of the weird mystery. It's a relatively simple tool. Now, I think that could change now that Twitter is going public, right? Because they're going to need to pump more money out of it, and that could fall apart. I think that new tools will probably always emerge that satisfy our desire for a simple interaction that does one thing really well. The reason why Instagram took off, because it did one thing really well: share a picture and comment on it. And, you know, I would not be shocked if that corrodes into a mess of tweaked ad sales over the next few years until the next thing comes along.
Sure.
In my ideal world, we start to realize that we don't need these large, expensive corporations to do things that are nothing more simple than putting a little bit of text online and letting people comment about it. I think that it's possible that tools like that could start to emerge that are more like things you just run on your own laptop at home that let you network with people.
Sure.
Like a truly distributed internet would be a powerful thing. I don't see that happening right now, but that is my fervent dream.
I recently read The Shallows, which is a book that you sort of address at the beginning of your book. Mm-hmm. Do you talk with Nicholas Carr? Are you guys, excitedly debating the eventual outcome of all of this?
No. In fact, I actually don't know Nick at all. I like his writing a lot. As I say in the book, I think that I think he did an amazing thing in The Shallows, which is that he intervened nicely with the idea of multitasking. You know, because before The Shallows came along, there was still – a lot of people still thought, you know, multitasking is a good thing. It's good – you know, I'm somehow, you know, working on the edge of my cognitive capabilities if I'm juggling nine things at once. And he decisively dismantled that by showing – from all the social science out there that if you try and do four different things at once, you will do none of them well, right? And this is corrosive for thought.
Right.
And I think finally that's starting to sink into people, you know, because more people have picked up on that argument, and I completely endorse that argument. Where I think I part ways with him is that he was very concerned with the idea that if you are not doing deep immersive reading, you're not really thinking.
Mm.
And I don't quite – as much as I am a deep immersive reader a lot myself, I just don't think that's a sum total of how we think. We actually think a lot of the time very socially. We're pinging things off people face to face. We've done that, you know, for – you know, hundreds of millennia. We're smarter when we're in dialogue with people. And so the great thing about the internet is it has put us in dialogue with more people. Because we're social beings, we're social thinkers, and this is a great social environment. So I tend to see more upside in that than I think he does.
If you have to give one example from your book to someone who really, really distrusts, and maybe you just did, but I just wanted to ask if there's one example, a specific example from your book that you witnessed or studied that can really serve as your challenge to somebody who is distrustful of the large arc of technological history. What is that example?
Sure. There's no simple example, but one that I really like is the story of how Ushahidi came to be. So Ushahidi is this very cool tool. It's an open source mapping tool. It's basically a Google Maps mashup that when there's a crisis, you can throw this map up and let individuals contribute to it with whatever they know. So like in Haiti, when they had the earthquake, people put up one of these free Ushahidi maps and people started tweeting where people were buried under the rubble, where they needed medicine, where they needed help. And this became so valuable that the UN and the US military were relying on it because that's how good the crowdsourcing is for Ushahidi. It's a free tool. It's an open tool. Now, that came into being because of an act of public thinking. There was a blogger, Ori Okolo, Kenyan blogger. She had been, you know, just doing that public thinking thing, you know, writing a blog, not a huge audience, maybe a few thousand people, but, you know, in dialogue with them about politics. And when she saw the Kenyan election exploded in violence in 2007. She wrote, she was just thinking out loud, she said, God, it would be great if there was a mapping tool that let people contribute data to a map and crowdsource where things are happening in a crisis. Because she was thinking out loud, because she was not just keeping this to herself, within 24, 48 hours, several programmers contacted her and they put that tool together and it has gone on to save lives in crises around the world. And this to me is the perfect example of what happens when you realize that individuals can speak in public, can think in public and the connections that emerge from them. It's why I always say, you know, because we're social thinkers, thinking in public has this catalytic power and there can be really good things in it. It's not just narcissistic, you know, whining online. It's not just trivial stuff.
Photos of my lunch.
It's not just photos. Even photos of your lunch can be kind of interesting in building social capital, right?
Sure.
So what I try and point people towards is the examples where when someone was thinking in public, amazing things happened. And if they had just been quietly in a room thinking by themselves, the wonderful thing wouldn't have happened.
Clive Thompson is the author of the new book, Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. Clive, thank you.
Thanks so much. Enjoyed being here.